Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Bruce Weigel. Bruce Weigel is the author of more than a dozen books of poetry, including The Unraveling Strangeness, Archaeology of the Circle, New and Selected Poems, Declension in the Village of Chunglung, What Saves Us, and Song of Napalm, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. A U.S. Army veteran, Weigel is the author of the best-selling memoir, The Circle of Han, which recounts his struggles in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. He has won the Robert Creeley Award, the Lannan Literary Award for Poetry, the Patterson Poetry Prize, the Poets Prize from the Academy of American Poets, the Cleveland Arts Prize, and fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Yaddo Foundation. Weigel has written several collections of critical essays, published translations of Vietnamese and Romanian poetry, and has edited or co-edited several anthologies of war poetry, including Writing Between the Lines, an anthology on war and its social consequences, and Mountain River, Vietnamese poetry from the wars, 1948 to 1993. After teaching at Penn State University for many years, he returned to Lorain County Community College as its first distinguished professor. In addition to teaching, he founded a student veterans group and an online literary journal titled The North Coast Review. His new collection of poetry, entitled The Abundance of Nothing, will be released from Northwestern in March 2012. Hi, Bruce. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's such a pleasure to have you, and I want to make sure to congratulate you on your new book.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be in Pittsburgh. This kind of weather reminds me of the day that I went and got my cat, whose name is Bill, and I'm going to read a poem about him.
Okay.
Someone had left him in the cold, the black and white cat I found at the pound, and the kind people took him in once they had reported to work. They put him in a cage with a blanket, some food and water, where I found him, and how could I have said no to Bill, named to honor my uncle, who'd won a Silver Star for glider landings in the dark, and who asked the nurse the last time I took him to the VA hospital in Lorain, Ohio, which is another kind of story, just days before he died, "You don't work for that Kevorkian, do you?" Bill lies across the table where I try to work. He stretches his long body precisely out across the paper, so it's impossible to write a single word. This is a poem that I wrote after my first brain surgery. It's called The Room. It's a poem that I wrote for a nurse who took care of me. I didn't ever want to lose your face. The way you found me in the darkened room, my brain an open wound and me not sure of anything. The gurney wheels brought me here to you. The morphine freely came, yet it was more the sweetness of your voice. The way your hand felt on my brow, the way you leaned the weight of you against the pull of other duties waiting down the hall that eased me back, the anesthesia gone. Then I awoke and you no longer there. And what I wanted has the name of everything, the brain relieved, the pretty scar, the room whose dark I lavished in, and you in me.
I've never heard anyone say, "This is what I wrote after my first brain surgery." That's intense. Can you talk about your writing related to your surgery and the changes that might have taken place?
Yeah. I'm just starting to figure it out, so I probably don't have a lot to say about it. But and I hadn't expected the kind of changes that came, and no one had told me about it. But then again, you know, I think the doctors were treating me as a patient and not as a patient who was also a writer. So it wasn't a consideration. And, you know, given where the surgery took place in my brain, I knew that even if something had gone wrong, it really wasn't a part of my brain that would affect what I imagine were the parts that I used to be a writer. But when I started writing again after my first major brain surgery, after I had the shunt put in, was eventually taken out and put back in, but the words came out differently when I wrote. And one thing I noticed that started happening was that I was hearing a much more English-like line that poem that I just read. Now, I soften that because I don't rhyme very often at the end. I do more in the middle. So it's not as heavy-handed as it might be if it was rhymed. But they're pretty regular iambic pentameter or iambic tetrameter lines. And that was the music that was coming out of me for some reason. I'm never one to argue with what wants to come out. I'll write whatever the brain is telling me to write. And I worked that way for 5 years, writing this book. And I also wanted to write about the whole experience going through the brain surgery and going through recovery because, not as a victim, but because it's pretty interesting. And the changes are very subtle. You know, they don't want you to ask the question, will I be the same afterwards? Mm-hmm. They would never answer that question. Mm-hmm. But that's the question I wanted to ask. Sure. And the answer is no, you're not the same. It changes you somehow. A little bit. It's almost like the angle of vision is a little different. Or, you know, it's not about confronting death. That's not what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's more, I think, more neurochemical than that, that the processing is somehow altered.
Well, I know that sound has always been really major to you in your work. Mm. And do you think the sounds are different? I mean, do you think that you take in or give out sounds differently now?
I do, yeah. Well, now it's changed again because in December I had this other surgery. And they had to take the shunt out 5 years ago because I developed a brain and spine infection, and they took it out and left it out, and then it just stayed out, but the problems continued, so I had to have it put back in December. And once again, in my recovery, I can't do much but sit around after this. So I do a lot of writing. Just nothing real purposeful, just whatever occurs to me, trying to remember the moments coming out of surgery and trying to think about my brain and the relationship between my brain and my body now, and just writing whatever occurs to me. And, I discovered that there was a whole new voice now. It's a different person. It's a different character, which is a blessing in some ways because, you know, I try to do that anyway with new books.
Yeah.
But it's not so easy to do, and there's always this kind of transformation where you're still writing the last book halfway through the next one.
Right. But, this reinvention.
Right. But with this one and with the new one that I'm working on now, it's more like I feel more like I'm acting sometimes than I'm writing. That I found this character as a result of my brain being altered somehow. And I can just become him and I speak from his point of view.
Well, I mean, you're writing beautiful poems. So.
Thank you.
Okay. Can we hear more?
Yeah. I'm reading from The Abundance of Nothing that you kindly introduced.
That's coming out in March 2012 by Northwestern, and we can't wait.
This is called My Nymphomaniac, as opposed to Your Nymphomaniac.
Let's not get into that.
Too young to know any goddamn thing about women, I stood in the alley with one Karen Mendez who told me she was a nympho and who said she had a rubber, neither of which I could identify, but I could tell from the way her eyes lit up in the dark alley and the way she moved her 13-year-old body in the fractured light that came to us that something important was about to happen. Then she reached her long fingers under the legs of my shorts and found me, so my legs straightened out on their own as if I were at attention. Then she kissed my mouth so I couldn't breathe, my God, and she pulled her own shorts off and tried to climb up on top of me there in the alley, and I began to think that I'd made a mistake and set myself up for some trouble as the alley closed in on us like night and she rubbed against me in a rhythm I remembered from another time and place. And I could hear voices from the corner where my pals hung out, whom I longed for, and I could hear music from someone's record player leak out into the night sky and seem to settle there for a moment and then disappear. This is a poem I wrote for my neighbors called For My Neighbors. The faw, stone, naked torsos in my neighbor's garden must signify something, as this coffin I carry around on my back means something, my bed or my field to lay myself down in, you know. I love my neighbors, even the ones I don't know and so must imagine lives for, even those who hide behind the curtains in the heavy odor of their secrets that spread and tangle like vines until there is nothing left to see or to love. We are all in this together, this lawn mowing and leaf raking until death, this trash hauling and gutter cleaning metaphysics. It's what we have in common, and I am grateful for the dogs walked past my house and for their shrill barking in the early morning cold, like today, for example. And even though you don't know my name, I am happy to be among you, safe in our unspoken village, the walls of our courtesy like broken glass embedded stone. I think this is a poem that was about my 30th high school and reunion. I started going to those again because it's good for the writing. You know, it triggers memories that you don't otherwise have. It's kind of sad, too, though.
Yeah, I went to the 10th, and then after that I was afraid.
Yeah.
So it's like,
but see, they get
brave.
Better. You know, they do.
Yeah.
Because people, you know, people mellow and...
they get better, okay.
The lines that were drawn begin to disappear as the years, yeah. 10th, they're still there a little bit. This is called Reunion. As the popular girl walks among us with a microphone, most of our stories are about loss or include exquisitely precise medical and pharmaceutical details, as if the words could suture the wounds or save us even one last breath. I came to dance with the Puerto Rican women of my class of 1967 and to remember a few pals lost in the war who had been so beautiful you were happy just to look upon them, and one more boy, lost to his own drunken wildness under the moon, who doesn't remember us. It's not a going back we long for, but a staying still for one incomparable moment, all the lost love's faces spinning in the mirrored ball.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Bruce Weigel. He's reading from his new book. It's called The Abundance of Nothing, and it's going to be released from Northwestern in March 2012. Okay, I've always been surprised by the moves in your poems, and often it's a move to the abstract, to the green world, the otherness, mm-hmm. or to the wide, wide picture. And, you know, for example, in the neighbor poem that you just read, mm-hmm. you know, that move to go to hiding behind curtains mm-hmm. and the heavy odor of their secrets. And when that happens, I think, I love that. But then I think, how did he do that? And because it's hard to go to heavy odor of their secrets, but it seems like you move and then you leap so quickly. There's a compression of leaping. Uh-huh. And can you talk about that? Because I just really
sure.
admire it.
Thank you. Yeah. And you know, I have my teacher, Charles Simic, to thank for that in my work.
Yeah.
I did my master's with Charlie. As a matter of fact, I'm the first graduate of that program at UNH.
Wow.
And that was something that he taught me how to do, very specifically. And then there's Bly's idea that I like very much of leaping poetry.
Sure.
And, you know, I think I learned along the way and certainly came to believe that, you know, that poetry is not prose. It's a very different animal. And that it means in different ways, and that other things are possible, other kinds of connections with language are possible in poetry that, generally speaking, aren't possible in prose. There are lots of exceptions in experimental fiction, etc., South American fiction. But in general, prose can't do those things because it's too difficult for the reader. But it's possible to work those kind of problems out in poetry. It's not easy to go to that smell, because to that odor, because everything is telling me don't go there.
Right.
You know, that doesn't make sense. Don't go there. But what Charlie used to hammer into our heads is trust your instincts, trust your hunches. And that's the first thing that comes to you when you think about writing. And what we do early on especially is we translate that because we don't trust it. So, you know, James Wright has a wonderful poem that begins, "I'm almost afraid to write down this thing."
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he thought of writing that down. Most writers would skip over that part
right.
and start with the poem. But that's the instinct that I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
is the thing said. And, you know, it was a mixed blessing, because for a long time I got the kind of criticism that said, this isn't really poetry, or the language is too ordinary.
Yeah.
It's just the way we talk. And, you know, people who were not understanding that, it's really hard to do that.
Yes, yeah.
To write like you talk, or to use that kind of diction.
Well, I mean, a lot of people do the leaping thing in their poetry, but it's not the way you do it. And I think some of it has to do with the speed. I mean, you go right to it sometimes, and I love that. And I guess it's what you're saying, that instinct to just not set it up. Just go.
Just go, yeah.
Yeah.
And get rid of that connective tissue to boil it down to just that essence. That's what I was talking about last night a little bit with regard to, I love telling stories, but I love the lyric tendencies too, what the lyric can give us. So, you know, all these years, that's what a lot of us have been doing. Your work is the same, is this struggle between those two things.
Right, yeah. Yeah, but I've read a lot of you. Okay, can you read some more?
Yeah. This is called The Country That We Love. Before the stand that sold peaches and sweet corn in the summer, someone had stood up a mannequin dressed in a gold lamé bikini and red wig with tiny American flags in each hand that undulated in the breeze. And I thought, isn't this the country that we love? Isn't this perspective of clouds and despair deeper than usual? Vultures circling lazily in the distance as if at the end of a long tunnel. At the end of the day, it rains through some sunlight. Birds gather. They gather and swarm and make their biometric shapes against the white sky. This is a six-part poem, but it's really not that long because the sections are very short. And this is a poem that I wrote during the first brain surgery episode. Before I wrote this, before, during, and after, I was keeping a kind of journal, but not a typical journal. It was more an impressionistic journal. I just didn't want to fall into this, I had brain surgery and oh my God kind of thing, which is easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
I was much more interested in other aspects of it, more like looking at myself in the third person.
Mm-hmm.
It's called My Waiting Brain. One. There are pathways he must follow when he goes into my brain, or else something catastrophic might happen. He said any kind of bleeding in the brain is not good. I think he was talking to himself. Meantime, my waiting brain said, love yourself. Love your pain and your illnesses waiting down the road for you like old friends in the shade. Better spend some time tonight looking at the stars. Two. Empty again. As the dead hawk's heart is empty of blood on the highway where it must have slammed into the truck's windshield at, say, 65 miles an hour is how my brain says the world looks today, although it may be this unseasonably warm winter of green grass and geese who don't know which way to hoot that has my head spinning, the way a too warm December evening can hold still its last moment of light right before your eyes. Three. Help. My waiting brain says, and then, screw you. He woke me up at 4 a.m. with his pal, Mr. Spinning Room, in our private field of opiates, so all I could do was lie there and listen to the rain murmur in the night, the sound like someone who is lost talking to herself in the dark. Four. Good morning, highly polished chrome nightmare tool. You look fine this morning, like a silver snake bristling alive in every scale, longing to be inserted into my waiting brain to wind down the tunnels of me once and for all. Five. We were celebrating the birth of Jesus Christ the Savior by stuffing our bodies with food and wine. So, like the Romans, we fell into a stupor afterwards, a semi-comatose state, especially the men. Everyone was otherwise preoccupied, and although I was surrounded by the snoozing, snoring bodies of my people, it was as if I were alone, just my waiting brain and me. Night came with its enormous rotation of stars, so something seemed possible, even if it wasn't hope, even if the thing we spend our lives moving toward is unknowable until it's too late to turn back. Six. In the dark, I wanted peace, my waiting brain told me, as if that's too much to ask, as if sacrifice is too much to ask, given everything I've done for you. And how could I argue? 7. In the end, my waning brain said, dismantle me, but don't undress. The blue spruce watch us through the blowing snow. Forgive my forgetfulness, but I don't remember my name.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest today is the poet Bruce Weigel. He's reading from his new book of poetry, The Abundance of Nothing, published by Northwestern. Beautiful poem.
Thank you.
It's kind of ironic, you know, you feel, I'm thinking about the separation from the self, and you're talking about writing in the third person and writing as an actor or having it be acting almost. Mm-hmm. When the body is primary, mm-hmm. it's kind of, you know, strange.
In what way is it strange?
Well, because it seems like...
It would be the other way around?
Yeah, like the body, it would be all body. You know, you'd be more in.
But maybe it's because it's the brain. Maybe if it was some other organ.
Yeah, maybe.
These poems do feel a lot more physical to me.
Yeah.
In ways that maybe I couldn't understand, couldn't explain. But I, you know, I've painted for as long as I've written. And I'm a closet painter. I'm married to a painter who has helped me a great deal. But, you know, she always, her argument was always, don't learn how to do this the right way. Mm-hmm. Do it like you're doing it.
Yeah.
So, what I love about painting is the physicality of it.
Yeah.
You know, I love getting my hands dirty, and I love moving the stuff around on the surface. And these poems feel a little bit more like that to me.
Yeah,
I feel like more. So there is more body in it. There is a kind of body awareness, I think.
Yeah. It feels very present and very inside. Uh-huh. Sort of like inside the body.
That's right.
Yeah. I'm wondering if, you know, I know, thinking of your work over time. You know, when I think of your work, I think of collisions of, you know, of terror and beauty, and it's almost like that's still happening. Mm-hmm. With the brain now, but it has a different feel to it. Mm. The poems have a different feel. But when there's these collisions in your work, I never feel like it's never like there's a wreck, but like a continuum of organic movement, you know? And I remember years ago you talking about, you know, Robert Stone and his first, his introduction to Song of Napalm.
Yes.
And I love all that obsession of, you know, where does the beauty meet the horror of things?
Yes.
So I'm wondering, do you feel still really grounded in that obsession?
I do. It must be my nature.
I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah. And I can trace it back to my childhood.
Yeah.
The way that I grew up and the things that happened to me along the way. And I think there just were a series of events that kept telling me this is the way things are. You know, there's the great stuff, and right next door, this bad stuff's going to happen. And you can't imagine a world without one or the other. That, you know, I think it's a writer's responsibility to talk about what Grace Paley said, the story that no one wants to hear. Mm-hmm. Those are the poems we have to write, the poems that no one wants to hear. That's a good question, not a very good answer, but
it is
something it's not a real conscious thing, but I know it's there, and I'm fine with it being there, and it has something to do with my Buddhist practice too, I think, and that is like seeing the
your what practice?
My Buddhist practice.
Oh, okay.
Seeing seeing no differences in people and in actions and in things, and that we're all the same, you know, the teacher says, the Dalai Lama says, all lives are hard, and the difficulty in our lives are relevant to our lives, and I think that's part of it too. That you know, in Western thinking, we like to like divide it. Here's the good over here, and here's the bad over here. Here's the truth. Here's the lie.
People don't want them to touch.
Yeah, they don't want them to touch. No.
But you are definitely touching them.
Yet of course they are. They do touch. They're interwoven.
Yeah.
Even.
Yeah.
So I like to get at that aspect of our life.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Okay, we have time for some more poems.
This is called A Little Place on the Beach. This is what all of us want now at our age, is a little place on the beach. And now the blast of spring you have to suffer in all its exaltation. Open certain doors and you better know more than you do or the caring and the compassion, because something that you can't shake off, like a chemical pain in the blood, or like the pain of some memories that won't let go, persistent as vultures circling in the deepening sky, in the measureless sky full of holes. I don't know what comes when the shadows harden into walls that make a maze, and the day's flinching light gives way to hallucination and wonder, but it's like a certain trouble deep in my brain and out of whack that's hard to fix, as heartache is hard to fix inside someone. Some dead follow you forever, as in a boat along the shoreline, between the dazzling world in all of its neon nothing and the body you must carry through the dark jungle rain. And all I want is a little refuge, a little place on the beach in my mind. This is called To Know Spirits Speak. This is a warning to all of you out there. To Know Spirits Speak. I wanted to break through, you know, and get fresh with the other side, because I kept seeing those lost ones moving back and forth, mainly in the trees. You know, that other world seems so close. As on the other side of the leaves, the wind from nowhere turns over, dark to light. But hurt can reach across those borders too. Someone can call back to you through the waves of pain, and you could hear it like a loud bird trapped inside your head. This is called apocryphal weather. Chaos in the distant thunder I hear, like misdirected artillery, and the ghosts left in its wake, and the most lovely summer lawnmower noise next door somewhere. It fades and gets loud and then fades again, as long as I will listen. Today I won't die of loneliness, because the lilac scent blows through the screen, restoring me. This is called flash, and it refers to the idea of flashbacks associated with PTSD. When it's like the body remembers something that the brain isn't conscious of. And with the tanned and lovely sergeant, I watched the upper half of a peasant man convulse in the dust, the lower half blown away by a 250-pound American bomb the Viet Cong had rigged into a booby trap. The concussion rattled my teeth and my brain. I couldn't stop watching. For a long time, no one moved. I couldn't lift my foot to take a single step. I was flushed, soaked with sweat, swooning in the movement of the dying man. I thought that if I died too somehow, I would be released from the waves of sickness that rolled over me. But the sergeant saw something like a pale curtain come over my face, already my eyes rolling back in my head and my knees giving way to the stinking power of someone else's death right before your eyes. So he grabbed my arm and shook me back to where I needed to be to go on. "It don't mean a thing," he said, and we turned back to the trees in their safe shadows and cool.
The poetry of Bruce Weigel. It's reading from his new book, The Abundance of Nothing. Thank you so much, Bruce.
Thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
It was great. You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody. 90.5 FM.